This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Climate change, pandemics, political, economic, and social unrest. There are any number of reasons to look upon the future with more than a shiver of uncertainty. So you've got to prepare for that uncertainty, right? You've got to prep. Now, you could be a doomsday prepper with your at-home arsenal and MREs, or you could be a bug-out prepper like me. We've got go bags ready for my entire family in the event that we have to evacuate in a hurry. I'm thinking something like a hurricane scenario. We're also ready to shelter in place if we had to. That, though, is kind of small-scale prepping, because there's also the billionaire prepper.
You know, I've got sheltered bowling alleys, swimming pools, greenhouses, underground shooting ranges, you know, workout areas. Weapons storage is another big popular item that we do a lot of. You know, I mean, just you can almost name it at this point, and I've done it.
That's Gary Lynch. He's the general manager of Rising S Company, a residential bunker builder based in Murchison, Texas. Their motto: we don't sell fear, we sell preparedness.
It's not always wartime. You know, a lot of times it's people worried about, you know, Second Amendment loss. You know, it could be people, you know, worried about civil and social unrest. You know, it could be one of many things like that.
In fact, billionaire bunker building is a booming business. Gary's family business has been around since 2002. It's the largest and oldest in the industry. And at first they were building mostly storm shelters. But now it's shelters really designed for long-term stays.
My smallest shelter is 96 square feet. The largest one I've done is 14,000 square feet. So there's 140 of those small shelters, you know, square foot wise in that.
A 14,000 square foot shelter. I have a hard time imagining what that even looks like. But Gary told us the shelters are made of steel frames. They're about 40 feet below the ground and include things like bullet-resistant doors, air filtration systems, solar charging stations, and freshwater inlets. Prices range from just under $70,000 to upwards of $10 million. And that does not include delivery and installation.
If you can afford a shelter that costs $6 million, it's safe to say that you're not in an income bracket that's, you know, that's hurting for money.
But why would a billionaire need a subterranean bunker mansion complete with bomb-proof bowling alley? Do they know something we don't know?
I think that there is a polarity and a debt situation and circumstances in which there probably will have to be revolutionary type changes. Maybe they're the sort that happened in the 30s. Maybe they're, you go back to the 1860 period. You could have actual different types.
The 1860 period, that would be the Civil War. And that was Ray Dalio, by the way, speaking on CNN back in 2020. Dalio manages Bridgewater Associates, the largest hedge fund in the world. And to his credit, he has been speaking very forcefully over the past several years about the dangers of massive inequality, to the point where he's called capitalism as currently practiced, quote, a national emergency. But he's not the only uber-wealthy person worried about how angry you might get. You've heard that phrase, Davos man, right? Well, journalist Peter Goodman calls this hominid subspecies, quote, those so enriched by globalization and so native to its workings that they were effectively stateless, their interests and wealth flowing across borders, their estates and yachts sprinkled across continents, their arsenal of lobbyists and accountants straddling jurisdictions, eliminating loyalty to any particular nation, end quote. Well, even from the airy heights of the Swiss Alps at the World Economic Forum, even Davos man and woman are worried.
The pandemic has shown that the existing inequality in societies had now started showing its fractures. And that is also exactly why we need to double down on these efforts and ensure that the leaders are building the alliances, the partnerships to make change move much faster than it has so far.
That's Sadia Zahidi, managing director at the World Economic Forum this past May. Now, I'll just offer one observation here that, yes, change absolutely does need to move much faster than it has. But the Davos elite has been talking about inequality at the annual World Economic Forum for more than a decade now. And over that time, global inequality has just gotten worse. But I digress. Let's get back to underground billionaire bunker builder Gary Lynch, who counts those Davos types amongst his client list. Now, he wouldn't tell us specifically who they are, but he says lots and lots of celebrities are on the list, so are some politicians and tech titans.
For a while, it seemed like everybody in Silicon Valley was wanting to buy shelters.
And many of them are buying shelters while also planning for an expat life. Their bunkers are being built in New Zealand. Now, Gary told us that bunker sales tend to go up under Democratic presidencies and fall under Republican ones. So, as you can imagine, business has been very good for Gary lately. Global unrest also drives sales. For instance, when Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th of this year, Gary's company sold 5 bunkers just that day. They typically sell that many in an entire month. So what's going on here? That question is answered in the new book by Douglas Rushkoff. The book is called Survival of the Richest: Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. And Professor Rushkoff joins us now from New York. Douglas Rushkoff, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Meghna. It's so good to be with you.
So how big is your bunker?
Small. My bunker is a state of mind. No, my bunker is, honestly, I mean, this is almost the end of the book thing we're talking here, but my bunker is planet Earth, right? We're all in this bunker together. If we realize that there is no escape, we're here with each other, we'll, you know, embark on a very different survival strategy, I think.
Okay, well, I want us to actually then jump back to the beginning of the
please.
Book, right? Because I couldn't resist asking you about your bunker.
Yeah,
you know, mine's like a planet Earth
nothing.
Also, and a backpack.
I got a box of Cliff Bars. I mean,
well, you know, we all have to start somewhere. But,
but
I mean, so speaking of the start, you tell this incredible story of why you started getting interested in these escape fantasies of billionaires, as you talked about it. Can you tell us about this bizarre, fascinating meeting you had in the American high desert?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, for people who don't know, you know, I'm like a tech thinker. You know, I write about technology and society. I'm kind of an anarchist, Marxist kind of a thinker, cultural, you know, guy from back in the cyberpunk days. And because I wrote some of the first books on this stuff, I often get called in by really wealthy tech investors to kind of, you know, pontificate on the digital future so they know where to place their bets. And I try to do it less and less, but I got this one offer for really what to me was zillions of dollars, you know, 1/3 of my annual teaching salary to fly out to some desert resort and do a talk about the digital future for some investors. So it's like, whatever, you know, money talks, I talk, so take the gig, you know, fly out business class with warm nuts and everything. It was just great. And get taken, you know, the next day they come to my room and bring me out on a golf cart to this little facility. And I'm waiting in my green room to be taken out, you know, to get the little mic put on and be brought out for these guys. And they brought 5 men into the green room and they sat around this table and it's like, this is the talk. And they didn't want to hear my prepared talk about, you know, the digital future. They just started peppering me with these very binary questions, you know, like, you know, Bitcoin or Ethereum, augmented reality or virtual reality, like which should they bet on? And finally, they got around to Alaska or New Zealand. And they spent the rest of the hour asking me really to water test their survival strategies. They were talking about all the things that you were just had in that piece. You know, do we go underground? Do I get an island? Can I do seasteading? What about space? And we ended up spending the majority of the hour on the single question, how do I maintain control of my security force after my money is worthless? Right, the ultimate prep questions, because they've all got this money. They've, you know, contracted Navy SEALs to come out to their compounds. But then they're thinking, well, what do we do if our money's worthless? Then why are the Navy SEALs not just going to kill us and take all the stuff?
Wow.
And I just was floored because I'm thinking, I'm in a room here with the wealthiest and most powerful people I've ever been in a room with before. I mean, these are at least 2 of them of the 5 were definitely billionaires. And the other 3, I couldn't find their exact wealth, you know, rate, but close to it. And here they are feeling utterly powerless to influence the future, that the very best thing they can do is prepare for this event, the inevitable catastrophe, and just kind of hang on for dear life. And that really set me out on this journey to figure out where did this mindset really come from?
Well, so I just want to add, the book is so full of rich details that this was also, this meeting was, as you describe it, kind of almost in the middle of nowhere, right? You had to drive, what, 3 hours from the airport to get to this secret undisclosed location?
I know. It was like way out. So I flew to a regular airport, you know, whatever, that real planes land in. And I'm driving 2 or 3 hours and I'm thinking, what kind of resort would a billionaire person go to that requires 3 hours of driving? And then it's like, we're going over this bluff and I see this airstrip, this private, you know, municipal little airport thing. And I'm like, oh, and then all the G5s and, you know, Learjets are there. And like, that's how these guys get here.
Well, and so then they were asking you, it was just five people sitting in front of you in this
the whole
room.
Thing.
Yeah. And they were asking you about, you know, as you said, how to keep control over their security, their underground security force, which, to be clear, they have already hired these people. Like, these Navy SEALs are already on contract for them, like, in reality.
Well, this is what they say. I mean, it's really hard to know when you're talking to tech billionaires what's real and what's not. I mean, you've seen the talks of, you know, Peter Thiel and Elon Musk, and half of what they say is conjecture, right? So at some moments, it felt like these guys were playing a poker game with each other, like that they wouldn't even let each other know exactly what they have, as if they don't want to reveal too much to each other, you know? So I kept thinking the walls were going to come down and the whole thing would turn out to be a game, but, you know.
But they were incredibly earnest, though, in their concerns, is what you're saying.
Yeah, they seem to be anyway, yeah.
Okay, well, today we're talking with Douglas Rushkoff. He's a professor of media theory and digital economics at the City University of New York in Queens. Has written for decades about humanism and technology, and his latest book is Survival of the Richest, Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Douglas Rushkoff joins us today. He has been writing for several decades now about humanism and technology. Lots of books you might have heard of, including Team Human and Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. His latest book is called Survival of the Richest, Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. And by the way, we've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Now, Professor Rushkoff, I want to talk with you more about what you call the event, right? This thing, whatever it is, that these tech billionaires are pretty sure is coming. Now, I actually have a lot of sympathy for that, right? Like, climate change is happening. We here in the United States, people feel on the knife edge of political unrest. If you're living in Ukraine right now or any other war zone, the event is going on right now. So what is the event in the mind of these billionaires?
It's interesting. I mean, when you talk about the problems, I understand them almost as kind of steady state problems, you know, these problems that are chronic and are going to go on. Like, how do you deal with hunger and climate? These are long emergencies, but the sort of the narrative arc that these guys are addicted to, maybe it's because every one of their businesses has an exit strategy, that they think that the world too requires an exit strategy, you know, where you leave or get out of that bad neighborhood and into a better one. They look at these, they are looking toward the end game, you know, that they want to be, they always want to be first. They always want to bet first. They want to have the thing. And they look at the way the world is going, you know, and they really believe that somehow with enough money and technology, they can escape the catastrophes of their own making. So they're making technologies that require slave labor or require kids to go into mines to get rare earth metals, or they're making printers that, you know, that brick themselves after a certain number of pages, requiring the person to buy another one, even though the printer is perfectly fine. It is as if, and I heard you play it in the opening, it is as if they think they can build a car that can go fast enough to escape from its own exhaust. But they realize that equation's not working anymore. You know, that they can't keep it up, that the devastation that they're externalizing to the rest of the planet, whether it is income inequality or you know, climate deterioration or any of a number of the things, or you know, geopolitical strife, uh-huh. And then there'll be some nuclear disaster. They realize that it can't keep going the way that they're going.
Well, so yes, so there's an inevitability factor here. Now,
yes.
Now, soon after your trip to that undisclosed location in the American high desert, you write about how apparently you stirred some things up because word of your talk got out and you got an email from the president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Latvia. Really fascinating. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. You know, I got a lot of emails because I posted a post on Medium. It turned into this viral hit, you know, about, oh my God, I did this talk and these guys are talking about the end of the world and they what happened? What is this Silicon Valley mindset that would lead these people to do that? Most of the emails I got after were from prep companies of one sort or another looking for investors or customers. Oh, introduce me to your billionaires. I have a bunker strategy to sell them. But this one guy, J.C. Cole, who's not the normal kind of guy that I usually speak with. I mean, he was kind of, a kind of right-wing, kind of Trumpy, a bit MAGA in his thinking. But he invited me to go to the sort of the prototype farm that he has. So he's developing these farms for people to go to after the event. And what he wants is, you know, you invest 5 or 10 or 20, whatever, $1 million now, and that guarantees you a place in this sustainable and highly defensible farm community. And he wants to build them around the country. And the interesting thing about him is, yes, there's guns and shooting ranges and all that kind of stuff. And I asked him, I said, well, what about, you know, are you worried about, you know, motorcycle gangs with machine guns coming and trying to take over your farm? And he said, and it was so sweet to me, he says, no, I'm less worried about the motorcycle gang than I am the woman at the end of the driveway with a hungry baby. Mm-hmm. So what his plan was, and this sounds so lefty progressive, right? What his plan is that a bunch of the money that people invest goes into a business that teaches communities how to create sustainable farms of their own. You know, so, and he sees it not just as a good business strategy, which I think it is, you know, education, but it's part of the survival strategy is to have the rest of the world, the rest of the country able to take care of itself so they're not running at your farm with machine guns. And it's like, but that's why none of the Silicon Valley investor people want to join that one. They're all, I mentioned it to a bunch of them. They're like, well, why would we do that? Why would we waste any of our money on the other people?
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, so the reason why J.C. Cole was so interesting to me, in addition to like he gets us down the road of thinking, well, maybe in order to prepare for the future, we need to actually start treating people better now, which we'll talk a lot more about a little bit later, Professor Rushkoff. But again, I just can't fully yet step away from the fact that there are people out there who are concerned because they've lived through or observed similar collapses, right? I mean, because you mentioned that Cole had witnessed the fall of the Soviet Empire and what it took to rebuild a working society. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because he was out there in Eastern Europe when that happened, And part of the point of having a chamber of commerce, you know, was to rebuild an economy. And certainly anybody who's been at an economy that has nothing and has grown it into a working economy, most of those people are going to be kind of diehard capitalists, because it's about growth. You know, and certainly growth is important for a certain period from zero to sustainability. I mean, that's when people like me think, okay, then you transition to something other than growth. But, you know, that's what sort of made him, I think, so capitalist in his understanding of the world. But yeah, he witnessed what happened at the Soviet Union. So he thinks that we in America, we in the West, are about to undergo a similar collapse, because our supply chains are so long and so brittle that it doesn't take much. You know, one ship stuck in the Suez Canal, or one electrical outage, or one set of floods or fires can make it really hard for someone at the, you know, who's depending entirely on Costco and Walmart's trucks to bring them food, is going to be in trouble if the infrastructure stops working.
I mean, he's not so wrong, right?
He's not wrong. Yeah. He's not wrong. I mean, whether or not America is at a moment like the Soviet Union was, I mean, listen to NPR, and it certainly sounds like, you know, there's a crisis going on. So yeah, it is. He was part of that, and he did build secure facilities for diplomats, so he understands all about, you know, how to hide things and how to make things look, you know, less conspicuous. So he definitely has way more practical experience in working on and thinking about not full on, you know, Walking Dead doomsday scenarios, but kind of more realistic and hopefully temporary disruptions in society as we know
it. Yeah. Now, I will admit that your slings and arrow about doomsday radio, Professor Rushkoff, aren't entirely inaccurate. We have been accused of that. But my take on this is that we need to actually, all of us, we're aware broadly of the fragility of all the different systems we rely on.
Yes.
Our, you know, Mother Earth being system number one. Mm-hmm. And so one form of preparedness is to actually understand the sources of those fragilities as much as possible. And that's how I defend our doomsday radio take.
Oh, no. And I'm just saying, you listen to the news, you know, and you hear about the conflict in America and how many, 30% of Americans think a civil war is probable. I mean, that's not a good sign for the sustainability of a society.
Yeah. Well, which is why the idea that the people who are perhaps best placed in terms of their wealth, their power, their influence, and the technologies that they're creating, why they're not thinking actively enough, or at least insofar as we can see, about how to prevent problems, right? Rather, they're thinking about these escapist fantasies, as you call them, is so fascinating. Now, the book wonderfully sort of fluctuates between these big philosophical questions and then almost the practical absurdities, if I can call it that, mm-hmm. of the billionaire prepper fantasy. Tell me more about why you think, sticking with the bunkers for a little while, why these like completely closed bunker ecosystems you think wouldn't even practically work in the case of if the end times actually arrived.
Well, it was weird. I saw there's so many reasons. I mean, germs spread. You know, we just saw with COVID. You think you're hermetically sealed. It doesn't really work. Disaster in Fukushima led to, you know, we can still measure the radiation in fish that are caught up in Seattle. You know, the forest fires in California led to unhealthy air conditions on the East Coast. You know, you can't really isolate. You can't go to Mars either. I mean, Mars and Venus, those are less hospitable environments than the Earth after nuclear disaster. You know, it's like, good luck with that. Good luck with your Mars dome. It's just not, these are not practical solutions, not in the next, you know, decades or couple of centuries. They are, you know, they're ludicrous. And that's why I came to believe that these are not kind of realistic doomsday fears they're preparing for, but kind of active fantasies that on some level they want to be alone in a, you know, in a little computer controlled womb that brings them everything they want. You know, they want to escape from the rest of us. That's what they understand as success, is rising above all the mere humans and, you know, and being as gods, one level away from this doomed civilization.
Mm. Well, eventually you're going to have to come up to the surface to get more HEPA filters if it's a year or 10 years from now, right?
Actually, I was talking to one of them. He was talking about this heated pool he was going to have in his underground bunker, and I forgot where. And he was all talking about how he had artificial skylight down there so that he could be at the pool. And then he talked to psychologists about the need for, you know, sort of daylight balanced fluorescent bulbs in this pool. And I'm like, well, what about I have a friend who has a pool and it's always breaking. I'm like, well, where are you going to keep the spare parts? Like where are you going to get a filter? Where are you going to get a new heating element for your heated pool? You know, and he's like, oh yeah, I better order more spare parts. And he's like jotting things down on his pad, like parts for pool. Like, oh God, you know.
Yeah. He could just 3D print it. Okay, I'll just.
There you go.
That's my solution. But your point is well taken here. So, this gets us to what you call. You mentioned this earlier, but I'd love the definition of the mindset. Right? What is the mindset that you observed?
Well, the mindset is that you can have enough money and technology to insulate yourself from the problems that you're creating with money and technology. You know, that you can use sort of exponential growth to outrun the devastation you're leaving in your wake. And, you know, that was really what I got interested in, this kind of tech bro mindset. And there's so many, you know, interesting ways to look at it, but almost all of them come down to the idea that you, as a kind of a tech billionaire, are existing one level above mere humans. That they take Stuart Brand, who had the famous quote, you know, we are as gods, we may as well start acting like them. They take it seriously. I mean, look at Peter Thiel's book. It's called Zero to One. The idea is that if you're special, you rise one order of magnitude above the rest. Or you look at Mark Zuckerberg when Facebook looks doomed, right? The subscriber rate had peaked and public opinion turned against it. What does he do? He goes meta, literally meta on Facebook. I'm going to go one level above. We were Web 2, now we're Web 3. We're at Web 3, now we're Web 4. Or you can even look at the folks like Jeffrey Epstein, who believes he could act as some kind of a demigod, you know, ruling a slave race of people, of young women below him. And it's the same as their business strategies, which are always, you know, you leave the real world behind and you move to stocks or move to derivatives, which are once removed from stocks. And this, for me, goes back to digital, which, for all of its wonders, digital is a symbol system. It is not on the ground reality. It's kind of one level above. It is a simulation. And that's where these guys want to go. Their dream is to become what they call self-sovereign individuals. And whenever I hear that, I think, self-sovereign, what does that mean? So you're both the king and the subject, right? Self-sovereign. So you're even one level above yourself. And that's really what they're doing. They've got to get one level above. And that means, you know, in the end, it means escape. It means getting away from us.
But Professor Rushkoff, is this really a fair critique? Because the kind of techno-utopianism you're describing and the libertarianism that undergirds it has always been part of the story of Silicon Valley. And in a sense, it's that same utopian drive that has allowed for, you know, not just amongst the billionaires of Silicon Valley, but almost anyone who's attracted to that world, allowed for them to have, you know, the dreams and imagination that led to some of the greatest technological advances that we're all benefiting from.
For a moment, yes, you know, for sure. I mean, the devices we have, the things we're using even to communicate right now, these devices are amazing. You know, they are doing wonderful things. But the real world happens to be coming apart. And the people who are making these screens and things not only know that they are the cause, but they mean to escape the coming catastrophe and think their last best hope is to double down and apply, at best, even more technocratic kind of totalizing solutions to our world. And there was a turning point. I mean, I was part of the tech renaissance. I was an early cyberpunk hanging out with, you know, Tim Leary and Steve Wozniak. And it was a wonderful moment, that late 80s, early 90s moment, because we thought that digital technology could unleash the unbridled potential of the collective human imagination. Human creativity would be, you know, unleashed. And the problem was, people looked at digital technology and thought about it instead was, rather than how do we unleash collective creativity, how do we use it to make money? And those are two kind of different things. Instead of looking, you know, when we were kids and we were hackers, we always looked for exploits in the computer. Now what you do if you have a technology company is look for exploits in the human being, you know, to figure out how to develop algorithms that get people to do stuff that may not be in their own best interest. So it really, it turned from one thing into another.
Well, Douglas Rushkoff is with us this hour. His new book is Survival of the Richest: Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. More in just a minute. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Douglas Rushkoff is with us today. His new book is Survival of the Richest: Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. And we've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Now, Professor Rushkoff, this sort of mindset that you've talked about how tech billionaires essentially are constructing a mental world for themselves where they can decouple their sense of any personal responsibility for the catastrophizing future they see coming, right? You also talk in the book about how, you know, is there there's some science and research that supports your theory of this mindset?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, I don't know if I was, you know, fair enough to the mindset. Because it's not just these little tech bros who think this way, right? It's as old, you know, the mindset itself is as old as, you know, empirical science, which is, you know, Francis Bacon used to talk about, you know, that science would let us take nature by the forelock and hold her down and submit her to our will. You know, there was always a fear of women and nature and uncertainty and the people that you're going to go enslave and the forest, you know. So there was always this desire to sort of dominate and reduce nature. Make it less complex. But somehow capitalism and digital technology combined to really pump steroids into that mindset, which has been with us since Caesar and Alexander. They've always been conquistadors, you know, but this is different. And yes, you're right. What we found in recent studies is that wealth, it sounds insane to say it, but wealth erodes empathy. You put a billionaire in an MRI machine and show them a picture of someone in pain or someone suffering, and the parts of their brain that normally light up when you see someone else in pain, they don't light up. They don't identify with pain or the emotions of others. It's as if they have damaged frontal lobes, you know, as if they've undergone a kind of a brain trauma. And I think that's part of what makes it easier for them to think of winning this game as leaving everyone else behind. And it's part of why, and this is sort of the scariest part, but it's part of why the apocalypse for them, I think, is not really something to be avoided so much as a secret wish, you know, because if the worse things get, the more they can justify retreating to their virtual bubbles, you know, whatever those might be.
Uh-huh. But tell us more about that, because in that case, about that it's not something they wish to avoid, that's not unique, right? There's accelerationists out there.
Yes.
There's always been, you know, various religious groups that are, you know, preparing for the end times. We've got QAnon now. It seems as if this welcoming of the end times isn't limited to tech bros and their, you know, their seasteading islands.
No, it's not. It's not at all. And in fact, they're part of the same movement, if you will. You know, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Steve Bannon and QAnon are all part of a spectrum. You know, in some sense, it's interesting. There's kind of two kinds of tech bro responses to the coming apocalypse. One is the one we've been talking about. I'm going to escape. I'm going to get with my family and my Navy SEALs and go on Mars or go on an island or get away from everybody. You know, and that's sort of a certain kind of accelerationist. The other kind is like going to Davos or the World Economic Forum and having, oh, I've got a plan for a great reset. You know, I'm a tech bro and I went to Burning Man and did a whole bunch of ayahuasca. And at the height of my trip, I realized, oh my gosh, the world is suffering. So what I did was came up with a software solution, a kind of a Sim City thing. I'm going to call it, you know, Plan 2 or Game B or, you know, Next Generation Planet. And I'm going to go to Davos and use this kind of technocratic techno-solutionism and all this money to build a blockchain and you know, something that saves the planet.
The ayahuasca Burning Man part, are you just being facetious there?
No. This is actual. I've met many of them. I'm the guy they call when they have this realization. And, you know, I was at one meeting of people, I forgot what they were calling themselves, like the new human something. And it was like marketers, investors, hedge funders and all. And they hired some, you know, Buddhist chanters and shaman and stuff. And these were all people who had either psychedelic or spiritual experiences and realized that the world, they think uniquely realized, that the world really is calling out for help. And now they want to be the leaders, these freshly minted climatologists. 15 minutes into their realization, they think that, well, because we've been the leaders of the economy, we should also be the leaders of the new environmental movement. And I remember I was at one of those and I said, well, gosh, haven't you heard of, or do you know about, join the Extinction Rebellion, join the Sunrise Movement. There's a lot of great movements. And they're like, well, if we haven't heard of them, then they can't be any good.
Oh, God.
Well, all right. So there's a hubris to this. And the problem with that hubris is you come up with these solutions. And I write about these people, too. You know, like a former game designer who comes up with a plan for how to create an ecologically sustainable, perfectly circular village. So he's got these plans, and they're all, you know, PDF files and computer programs on how you irrigate the soil. All he needs is like 1,000 acres of forest that we could clear cut so he could build his solar paneled sustainable eco village. And it's like, wait a minute. So they don't have a theory of change. What they have is, again, another utopian vision for some future. And they all involve an ends justifies the means journey of some kind. Someone or something is expendable for this future. I mean, even now, the so-called long-term thinkers, what they're arguing, and these are people like Musk, are arguing that there's only 8 or so billion people alive today. But deep in the future, there will be trillions of people star-seeding the universe. And it's okay if people today suffer so that those people have a better time in the future. And that's not the way That's not the way to live. You know, it used to be you lived in a bad neighborhood. I remember my dad talking about this all the time when he was a kid. We lived in a bad neighborhood, in a tenement. We all lived in this. We all took baths in the kitchen. And I worked and earned money to get out of that neighborhood so you could be born and be raised somewhere better. Well, what about when your whole planet's a bad neighborhood? You know, the strategy has to change from getting out of the bad neighborhood to making the whole neighborhood better.
So, Douglas, I spent much of my childhood and teen years reading lots of science fiction. Mm. And I know that a lot of these tech bros probably read the same books, but it sounds like they didn't really do a very deep reading of the lessons that science fiction literature has to offer, right? Because very few of those books, especially the classics, are perfect utopias. They're more often dystopian because of the lack of consideration about all the problems that you're talking about. I mean, does it?
Well, think about them though. Think about these guys. So they're like 19-year-old kids going to Stanford or Harvard or Cornell or somewhere. They come up with a great idea, a truly utopian pro-social piece of technology, and then they get plucked right freshman year. Freshman year, they're plucked from Columbia to then go build this thing. So they transfer parental authority, not onto some professor, but onto some venture capitalist who tells them, you've got to pivot from what you're thinking to this so we can make 100x or 1,000x money and then have an exit strategy. And these kids are taken out of college before they've taken the history, before they've taken the ethics and philosophy and economics to understand what's actually going on here. They have a tiny piece of knowledge, and then their new teacher is someone like Peter Thiel, who you don't want to be your mentor, really, for anything except how to make money at the expense of everybody else.
So I have to say, I feel, oh my gosh, people are going to write me very angry emails about this, but I feel a lot of empathy for these escapist tech bros. And here's why. Because, I mean, we all see or are all concerned about the same uncertainty and catastrophe that you described they're concerned about. We have, in our minds, we all, no matter who we are, we have different versions of the event. And, you know, maybe we're all just, we just prep the best way we can. And if you're, you know, Meghna Chakrabarty, you get your go bags. Or, but if you're Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, you build a rocket to take you to outer space. So what's driving them, I feel a certain empathy for. But what concerns me is that if we think something's wrong about the way the billionaire tech utopians are approaching the coming end times, they're not going to self-regulate. The self-regulatory systems should be in our political systems, in our social and economic systems. And isn't that up to the rest of us to try to you know, force some kind of reckoning with amongst the billionaires, that really what they should do if they want to avoid a catastrophic future is help better the present right now?
Yeah, well, that's kind of my whole point. I mean, I wrote this book as a black comedy intentionally because I thought rather than being afraid of these guys or wanting to grab pitchforks and kill these guys, that we should be able to laugh at these guys. Because if we can laugh at their insulation equation and laugh at the Silicon Valley mindset, then we become more immune to it ourselves. You know, the moment I decided to write this book was actually during the kind of the height of the COVID crisis, of the pandemic. And I felt like, well, look at all of us now. We're all in our little COVID bubbles. Not all of us, but those of us who could afford it, we're getting DoorDash, Amazon Prime, and video doorbells, you know. And we're all, in some sense, enacting the same thing that they are, but on a much smaller scale. And it made me feel really bad about myself and bad about where we went with it. And it helped. I mean, a lot of us had this stuff already, but it certainly helped justify a future where people are spending more time in the safe play zone of their Oculus headset than out in the world with other people. And yeah, the way to change that is really from the ground up. It's worse. We can't depend on these guys. They are they're not going to save us, right? This is, I was in the room with them. They have no intention of saving us.
The political and economic incentives aren't there. They're just not
right
now, given what capitalism is, especially in the United States. But you've got some other models that you talk about.
Yeah, I mean, we can. I mean, there's again, it's super unpopular, but there's something called, can I even say it on the air, called degrowth. And the idea is that you could actually just kind of do less, right? Realize there is no winning, right? There is no winning. You know, could read a great book by James Carse from the 90s, I guess, or 80s called Finite and Infinite Games. And the idea was, you know, when you play a finite game, you win the game, but then the game is over. If you play an infinite game, the object of the game is to keep the game going. And I would say that's what we're in as a civilization. It's not about winning. It's about how do we keep this game going? And the way we do that is by getting more local, getting more social, by realizing that, you know, we don't have to keep growing the economy. Just like technology should be a tool for people to use rather than something that uses people, the economy should be a tool that people use to distribute prosperity, not a tool that people use to extract value from people and places. So it's as simple as instead of every family having a minimum viable product, you know, lawnmower that they get from Home Depot, what if the whole block shares one really well-made lawnmower? What does that do? What are the implications of that? Less lawnmowers are being sold. Uh-oh, we're sharing. Uh-oh, what does that do? You know, and that's where we have to start very slowly moving towards sharing, towards mutual aid, towards realizing that we are not obligated to the market is obligated to us. And that instead of trying to fix some future world, we make the world right now. If you're not doing it in the moment, then you're really not doing it.
Okay, so first of all, you can say degrowth. We did a show about that a couple of years ago, so it's okay. I think it's a really, really important sort of frame shift in thinking about who and what is an economy supposed to serve. But let's just run for another second with your lawnmower sharing idea. Look, under our current system, you share a lawnmower. One of the things that might happen is, if there is indeed a lawnmower manufacturing facility still existing in the United States, sharing a lawnmower might put those folks out of work.
Right.
So there's like deep change that has to happen.
Put out of work, and we got to flip. What is work for? Do we work in order to supply our fellow people with the stuff they need to live their lives? Or do we work purely as a way of proving that we deserve some portion of the spoils? You know, we should think about work as you work just like you make a product or start a business in order to fulfill a human need. If we can fulfill human needs with less work, that should be seen as a good thing, not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you said that the tech bros are not going to save us. I'm not going to dispute you on that point. Although I would argue that perhaps some of the very technologies that they're creating could be tools that we use to, you know, affect the future you're talking about.
Yeah, some sort of a drone dirigible is a way of getting across the ocean rather than a gas-guzzling jet. Sure.
I'd ride that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Technology can be developed to serve humans. It's just the problem is most of the solutions that actually work don't create sort of 100x, 1000x, 1000000x returns. The tech bro solution sets are saying, we want moonshots. We will give $100 million to the person who comes up with the idea that could scale to the whole planet and save the whole thing. What if it turns out it's thousands of little ideas that save us? You know, they don't have the economic model for that.
Well, Douglas Rushkoff, he's a professor of media theory and digital economics at the City University of New York in Queens. And his book is Survival of the Richest, Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. And again, you can get a taste of it at our website. There's an excerpt there. It's at onpointradio.org. Professor Rushkoff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. You are a lot of fun.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Be prepared. This is On Point.